The following program is made possible by grants from the Alcoa Foundation, the Mellon Bank Foundation, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Westinghouse Foundation.
The way I paint would be to first get an overall sense of an impression of what's going to happen. The composition is very important. Positioning on a page or in a canvas, how that is working is very crucial.
Interest in the arts that he has is not casual. He is a professional level, world-class artist in my judgment. And the reason that he is committed to that vision of doing things is that he has a dream in his mind about how life should be. And he reflects it in the way in which he goes about creating objects of art so that they become pictures, opportunities for us to imagine reality in a different way than previously we have been able to do.
No, they wouldn't let me be an artist. School system of Albany, New York. I didn't know it, and I don't think my mother and father knew it, thank God, until I got into college, that I had been selected in the ninth grade or in the eighth grade to be part of a control group. They picked out the brightest kids they could find, the genius kids they called us afterwards, and they matched us with other kids who were equally intelligent. And Group A was the group I was in. We were allowed to run as fast as we wanted to. Group B was held to the ordinary, and then they compared us. Thank God I was in Group A and not Group B. But being in Group A, there were certain courses you had to take, and others there was no time for. So when I asked to take typing because I was writing short stories, they said no. When I said I wanted to take woodshop, no. When I said I wanted to run the big art studies, no. Take calculus and algebra and solid plane geometry and solid geometry and Greek and Latin, all of which was interesting, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. The art came later on, and when I get in retirement, I'm hoping to actually get down to doing some real work on it as a formal student.
Leroy Irvis is not just a practitioner of the arts, and he's not just a supporter of the arts. He is both of those things. And that would make some people say that he's a Renaissance man. He loves and feels comfortable. And it isn't just a love and appreciation, and it isn't just the practitioner's craft. It's a total embracing of the spirit of the arts. I think it's because he has such a creative and endlessly creative imagination. And that makes for good politicians as well as good artists.
I said, I think you have a beautiful neck and your head is perfectly balanced on it. He said, well, when I was in high school, they used to call me Turkey Neck. I said, well, you go back and tell all those pig-necked friends of yours that Brian Cusey didn't think that long-necked women had turkey necks, and I don't think so either. I said, I'm going to do a carving of you, and that is called Patty, which is her name, Patty Waiting. So really the carving with the mallet and chisel became, I guess, as a form of relaxation. Then I realized, knowing a little psychology, that was very useful to me. And I realized that one night when I was living in the apartment, I came back particularly frustrated and upset. I'd forgotten about what the reason was in Harrisburg. And I started working on a carving and worked 3 or 4 hours on it and realized that by the time I got through, I had forgotten all about whatever happened at Harrisburg. You can't do anything with this when you're working with a tool as sharp as a razor, which can cut your finger off if you miss. Can't do anything but really concentrate on this. And when you're concentrating on this, the rest of the world disappears, really.
Never perhaps ever to return, or just never perhaps to return
ever perhaps returned is wrong.
Leroy Irvis just published a book of poetry, and my first comment when I read a few of the poems is that he doesn't write poetry like a Speaker of the House. He writes poetry like a poet. His poetry is quite personal, and I think that's interesting, too, in the it's showing the versatility that he shows in the ways that he uses language. He, in politics, he talks political, statesmanlike language, but always with the touch of the literary person. In poetry, he speaks to the emotional side of life, the feelings and deepest thoughts of the human being, of that particular human being and his experiences. And so I think it's his virtuosity with language that's so stunning.
This is my favorite poem, though. This is the one which...
Well, this is the heart of the whole book.
This is the one which I like. Nobody else talked about
it. Well, I think it overwhelms people because it covers so much territory and so much feeling.
There's a lot of...
It's hard to deal with.
There's a lot of symbolism mixed in with reality.
You know, I've only had a chance to read it three times, but it's something new comes every time.
There's no hawk hung any longer in our sky. So when you whipped by winds fierce and relentless, turned one last time to me, with cold and measured dread, I heard you kill me slowly, saying I never meant to hurt you, saying I can no longer stay.
Generally what I do is to lay it out overall to get a sense of what's happening in a basic way. And then it's kind of like a push-pull effect, going from a medium tone to darks and then to light. So you're pushing and pulling simultaneously in both directions.
Many of the black people in the community had been complaining for some time about the lack of black employees in department stores downtown. And even the Pittsburgh Courier, the powerful black newspaper, had mentioned it, but they just hit it every week in their columns and so forth. And black people spent a lot of money there. And the Urban League, interested in the employment of blacks in the city, made an issue of it. And Leroy seemed to think we spent too much time in rhetoric, and he thought something should be done about it. So he and his wife organized the first picket line that had ever been brought on in this city. I later learned it was one of the first in the country. And they threw the first picket line around Kaufman's store of 15 people. And in 3 hours, it grew to 26. And before the day was over, they had about 60 people walking around that store.
Within 24 hours of picketing, the department stores decided they'd had enough. And they signed an agreement, and every black kid who worked behind the counter in the department stores or any other store in Pittsburgh owes that job directly for that 1947 picket line.
Leroy was very articulate, he was smart, and he handled the English language well, and he was a very convincing speaker and a very good leader. I would call him a quiet professional. He never picketed any more after that, but he certainly believed in the picket lines, and he believed in working people having the right to strike.
During the 1940s and 47, the picket lines and so on, I was on the black side of this argument against white people who were doing this to me and to mine. As I grew up and grew older, and as I heard the prejudice in my own race against white people, against Jews, against Poles, against Russians, against almost everybody you can name who were not black, and even against some blacks, I recognized that the disease was in all of us. So I began then to see what could be done to help reduce the threat of infection. I guess that's the point in where my career changed, from being a firebrand soldier ready to hack and cut, to a person who was willing to say to both sides, each one is wrong in a degree, let us see if we can't recognize how each one is wrong, let us come together and see if we can't find a more equitable solution to the problem.
The Governor's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Celebration Committee hereby acknowledges the lifelong civil rights contributions and achievements of the Honorable K. Leroy Irvis. Your commitment to social, political, and economic justice exemplifies the spirit of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., dated January the 12th, 1988, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Congratulations.
Thank you. Doesn't it feel good to be among a legend, a living legend?
I would tend to see a certain sobriety, weightiness, deep thinker. Those are pretty much the impression I'm getting.
In favor of K. Leroy Irvis from Allegheny County, for office of the Speaker of the House, will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it, and K. Leroy Irvis from Allegheny County, having received the majority of all votes, is declared elected Speaker. Congratulations, Mr. Irvis.
Then I remember the sense of enormous pride that I had when I became Speaker. I still have that. It's the highest and most respect and honor that I've ever been given in my life.
You understand that as a speaker, when he handles the House and all the members of the House, that I think everyone feels that there's a sense of fair play, but also compassion, and he begins to handle and oversee the operations of the House in that way.
He came along at a time when politics and politicians had not given proper recognition to the black community leadership. And I think he was at the right place at the right time in that respect. Now, I'm not a member of the Democratic caucus, and I'm just guessing. On top of that, and far more important as I view it, was that the man is so good, he's so intelligent, he's so really qualified that you couldn't hold him back.
Do you solemnly swear that you
He tries to channel you into looking at things from a balanced perspective, to make sure that you don't have a myopic view of what's going on in the world, but you begin to see the impact of your decision and how it's going to impact on things throughout the Commonwealth.
And the Speaker now declares that this House is now officially in session for the years 1987 and 1988.
Several years ago, when I was majority leader, I think it must have been 69, a medical doctor came into my office and said to me, Mr. Leader, if we could take one drop of blood from the heel of newborn infants, we could prevent phenylketonuria. I said, phenylketonuria, what? He said, phenylketonuria. I said, what in the world is that? He says, the debilitating condition of the body brought about by diet, which can affect the mental stability and even the mental balance of the child and an adult. But if we could test one drop of blood, we could prevent it. I said, well, then why don't you do that? He said, the law won't permit it. I said, in that case, I agree with Mr. McCorber, the law is an ass. I said, we shall change it. We did.
He's one of the few people, though, in a debate that I've seen change votes. There are half a dozen people that have the ability to change the minds of the members when a vote's being taken by debate, and I would put him in that category. And there aren't many that can do that, because most people have preconceived notions of what they're going to do, how they're going to vote, and I have seen him do that. So he's very persuasive. He has a vocabulary that just won't quit. He's an old English teacher. His enunciation, everything about his presentation on the floor is superb.
When you think that the community college system is one of his favorite programs that he pushed very hard to see enacted into law, Act 101 that helps disadvantaged college students, the Higher Education Assistance Agency that makes loans and scholarship assistance available to young people all across the state. When I was in the Senate, I served on the Education Committee, and the scholarship program really was born in 1963, I believe it was, with the efforts of Leroy Orvis and many others, and I participated in that effort to bring that program to Pennsylvania for the first time. But his commitment runs very deeply and very strongly to education, to human rights, to human service programs, and it's really a reflection of his own philosophy and his own background. We're all the product of our experience and our family history and the things that make us individuals, and he has always been a champion of people that needed assistance, needed help, needed education, and his record reflects that. It's a remarkable record of real achievement.
I hate war. I hate those things which destroy other people. I hate poverty. I hate meanness. I hate prejudice, black, white, green, gray, or striped. I hate those things which diminish us as human beings. I love it when this House of Representatives rises above narrow partisan debate and says, we are the voice of the people, and we speak as their voice for them. I love this place, and I shall miss it, but I shall not return to it like a ghost begging to be let in.
I see the eyes as being, very crucial in any portrait. The eyes, what it's been said, that the eyes are the light to the soul. And so a lot can be said in terms of the expression of the eyes.
How you doing?
Oh my, yes. Isn't that a wonderful place? Bidwell. Not just clean and functional, but warm. A teaching institution. An area where people can be retrained to become useful again, where people can have hope again instead of being hopeless, where people are no longer dependent upon the welfare of others, but people are able to contribute to their own welfare. It's marvelous.
Mr. Orvis acts as a role model for all the students. I think that that's the unique part about him, is that he really is a world-class leader. And world-class leaders tend to not be and cannot be parochial in their interests. He appeals to the broad band, the broad spectrum of the human condition, the human circumstance, and he can speak just as effectively to a dislocated worker as he can to a black welfare mother, and does, because the nature of his experience and his vision about living includes all of them.
I'm studying to be literate. What caused you to come for it?
Well, my son had an illness that prevented him from finishing school. So I told my wife,
I will come here and help him to get to finish his course. So that's what I'm here. Now, he's upstairs now.
Yeah. So you're going as a partner with your son to make sure that he gets it.
Make sure he gets it. Yes, sir. My dad did it for me, and I'm going to do it for him.
That's great. That's good. That's wonderful. You've made my day.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, you have. There are two drives I've always had. The love of learning. I never get to know enough about anything. There's always something new to find out. Even when I think I know something, I find out it's not really enough. And the love of teaching and seeing other people learn.
And I've learned as the result of being around him that to lead the people, you walk behind them. And that is the way in which he has managed quietly to persuade and encourage us to be the best that we are capable of being. That's what a leader really does. He or she requires, insists, that only the best will do. And Mr. Irvis is very much a representative in that sense of those values.
Young people are his pride and joy. He has one bit of philosophy that I think it's interesting. He tells all of them, don't try to follow in my shoes, stand on my shoulders. And he's a great believer in education. He's a believer in perseverance. And he'll fight to the end to see that they get their just dues.
He has a deep and personal interest in young people, and I'm sure in each one of you and your achievements. It is with a great deal of respect and pleasure that I present to you the Speaker of the House, Kay Leroy Irvis.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I am just awestruck by the fact that he has literally changed the lives of so many people in a quiet way, in a persistent, very personal and very quiet way.
And more importantly, you will shape it and guide it.
Leroy Irvis was the man that I came to, for example, way back, it seems like a long time ago now, in 1985, when I was considering running for governor for the fourth time. And that was not something that you undertake lightly. And I needed some guidance and some advice and some help. And I went to talk to him about it, and he was probably the first person in the state at that time to declare publicly for my candidacy. So I've always said to him that he put me back on Broadway, so to speak.
When Mr. Irvis retires, yes, there's going to be a void. But I think what will be available to help fill that void is the little bit of him that he's going to leave with each and every one of us. The perspective that he's given us, the skills that he's given us. There's a lot of young folks, a lot of legislators who he's had a major influence on in their lives and how they operate. And I think it's now up to us to try to utilize some of those things that he has delivered to us.
There's something behind that smile. There's something behind the expression in the eyes, and it's not very clearly seen right away. And as I follow the lines in his face, and as I follow the creases and wrinkles and the contour and the way it forms his expression, then I'll probably get a better understanding of that.
Morning, Dallas.
Well, there are several answers to why I spend a lot of weekends on the flying field. Number one, there are no telephones here. And my staff is under strict orders, do not disturb the speaker when he's out flying.
It's just camaraderie. A lot of guys come out here, don't even fly, just sit around and talk, you know. Just
that's,
hang around and talk.
That's the fellowship.
That was our trouble with John. He just wanted to sit around and talk.
I wouldn't let him.
That's right. But you're right. Bob is right.
I had never had it pointed out so dramatically is when my wife came out here one time
for the our old-timers meeting. She said, now I finally know why you guys go out there. I said, good. I said, you enjoy flying? She said, no. She said, you've got to go out there to talk to each other about flying. And that's true.
It right. May not be peace with the world out there, but it's peace with the world.
I have and always have had an envy of the beauty of flight in the birds. And it's the reason why I fly sailplanes, which are airplanes without motors. They come closer to being bird flight than any of these which buzz around our heads here this morning. They're silent, long, slender, and beautiful wings, and they float in the air the way a bird can move. I guess, psychologically, it gives me as close as I shall ever be to being a bird and being free. And when that big glider of mine, which is 10 feet in span, is floating in the thermals overhead, gently moving up, moving down, journeying gently, there's a thrill to it that it's hard to describe. I suppose anyone who has written poetry as I have will understand that thrill. I shall never be a bird. That's about as close as I can hope to come.
This program has been made possible by grants from the Alcoa Foundation, the Mellon Bank Foundation, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Westinghouse Foundation.